Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My guest on today's show is one of the most successful comedians in the world. I'll let him introduce himself.
I'm half white, half Filipino, that's what I am. Which means my dad was in the military. That's not even a joke. That's real shit. A lot of soldiers were fighting for this country. My dad was dating. I'm his Purple Heart.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was a clip from Joe Coy's first massive Netflix special, Live from Seattle. After putting it all on the line to self-finance that special in 2017, Joe has since released two additional hours on Netflix. Now, he has put out a new memoir called Mixed Plate that goes beyond the jokes to reveal just how hard his road to international comedy fame has been. In this episode, Joe opens up about the systemic racism he faced early in his career and the incredibly tough decisions he had to make along the way, from turning down an opportunity to be Chelsea Handler's sidekick to refusing to take no for an answer from Netflix. All right, let's do this. Here's me with Joe Coy. So yeah, thanks for doing this. I know I was looking back. I remember we almost were going to do, you were almost going to do this podcast like 2 years ago when Coming in Hot came out, and then it didn't end up working out for some reason. But so I'm glad we're getting to do it now.
Yeah, thank God.
Now I really feel like I know you because I just finished reading your new book.
Oh, thank you.
Mixed Plate, and really enjoyed it. It was really, really, you have such an insane story, life story. And I, you know, so much that I didn't know even after watching your specials, because it really gets into some of the darker stuff that maybe doesn't always make it on stage.
Yeah, of course. You know, that's the beauty of a book, right? You get to be more detailed, and I also don't have to worry about relying on the punchline, you know, for me to justify saying it on stage. You know, it's hard, you know, because I still want to be funny, you know? Like, there's a lot of things in my act that I said, you know, about my family that were very personal, and I still had to find a way to make it funny, and I was proud of those things. You know, like the stories about my sisters moving out at 17, like, yeah, it's a funny joke, and a lot of people were walking up to me and, you know, saying, hey, my sister walked out at 16, and, you know, everyone was, like, relating to the joke, but I don't think that people understood just how traumatic that was as a kid to see that happen. You know, to see your two big sisters move out and being by yourself and not understanding why you don't have the courage to do the same. You know what I mean? Or it's crazy. It's a lot of identity that you face, a lot of identity issues that you face when you're a kid and realizing later on in life, like, wow, I went through a lot. Didn't realize it.
No, I mean, there's definitely this very distinct trajectory in your comedy career from sort of broader, less personal to more personal. I think that's the way a lot of comedians go, honestly, as they start to talk more about themselves and their family later on. But you talk about in the book how you really, it was like all dick jokes at the beginning. It was like that was your thing. And then it really, there was a moment where you started specifically talking about your mom that really changed things for you. So what was that moment for you where you, you know, said, now I'm going to start talking about my mom, and how did that change things for you?
It was, the thing was, I wish I would have wrote it a little better in the book, but basically what I was saying is it was easy to go to the dick jokes because it was easy to be funny that way. But how could I tell my story? Or how can I tell people who I was without doing the basic comparison shit? You know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to do the, hey, Filipinos eat this and white people don't eat that, right? Am I right? Like, I didn't want to do that, you know? And I wanted to do it the right way. I wanted to represent my mom's culture and my culture the right way and give it a voice to where people would relate to it and appreciate it. And I was willing to not do it until I figured it out, you know? And it wasn't until that one joke. It's so funny how it just lands on one joke, but it was Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. And I bought the Wii for my son, and just seeing my mom play the Wii with my son, I had to go on stage and say it and literally just say what describe what I saw, become my mom. And that's when I realized, oh, people understand this character. You know what I mean? People get this. This is just a mom playing the Wii, and oh, mine just happens to be Filipino. Boom. There you go. Now you know who I am. And now you can relate to it because moms just do the same mom shit.
And she only has one game. It's Wii Sport. It's the one that it came with, the free game, right? So she puts it in there and she closes it, right? And then she does it. She goes, Joseph, go ahead and pick one of your games. What sport do you want to play? I don't know, bowling? She goes, oh, that's my favorite. So she picks bowling, and then she selects her character. If you don't have a Wii, you can make your own character. She's made a character. And this character looks just like her. She's got short black hair, glasses, a red turtleneck, a fucking mole. And she goes, Joseph, I made one for you, too. I go, really? She goes, yeah. And I pick it. I pick Joe, and it's just a bald fucking guy. She goes, ha-ha-ha, it looks just like you.
Yeah, and it wasn't about her being Filipino necessarily.
Yeah, and that it took me years, man. It took me years to finally figure that out. And then when I finally realized that it was just stories that needed to be told, it was over with after that. I was like, I got a shitload of those stories.
Well, in the book, you know, there is this balance, obviously, between, you know, talking about your identity and being, you know, half Filipino, and then stuff that's more broad. There are a lot of stories in the book about your childhood, about facing, you know, anti-Asian racism, which obviously is something that's in the news right now as we're talking and is really taken. I don't think it's ever been talked about as much as it's being talked about right now. So how are you kind of thinking about that, you know, with your book coming out right now and that this is such a big topic? I mean, just how are you feeling about where we are, you know, in the country right now?
It's so crazy because I started writing the book, you know, almost 2.5 years ago, I believe. And it's funny because now with everything, you know, the light being shined on something that was so horrific and so evil, and that it took those things to really shine the light on, you know, and cause awareness and show just how ignorant, especially the ones that did it, how ignorant and evil they were. But what I love the most out of, if you could say this, and I hate saying it, but what I love the most out of what has happened, if we could say that, the community of people that have band together, you know what I mean? Like, it's unlike anything I've ever seen, you know, especially through my years, you know what I mean? Like, you know, seeing the type of racism that my mom had to go through. And it was kind of like, we lived in a time where it was just like, okay, well, let's not talk about that. You know what I mean? Like, we're just guests in this country. Like, that was the kind of mentality that my mom had. Even though she was an American, she still felt like a guest. And it's like, oh, of course you could do that to me. And it's okay. I get it, you know, but no, we're at the time where it's like, no, we don't get it. And it's not cool. And we're all Americans and we all live here. And if you fuck up and do something evil like that, we're going to band together and we're going to shut you down.
You know, I've read other comedians' books, and obviously, you know, I've interviewed a lot of comedians, and I think a lot, there's a cliche that comedy comes from trauma and all that. And it's true for some people and not true for others. But I think for you, it really is true. There's a lot of trauma in your background and obstacles that you had to face.
Yeah. It's just, you know, just the, you know, my Netflix special alone, you know, Live from Seattle. I always talk about Live from Seattle. And, you know, hey, look, Netflix has the responsibility to choose who they want on their platform. They have, you know, the people that are picked for that position, it's a huge responsibility. I get it. If I was in that position, I'd be the same way. You know, you make the wrong decision, cost you your job. I'm not making an excuse, but what I'm saying is I get it. It's a business, right? And so they didn't choose my special for 2017 when I kept asking them. Even though I didn't understand, I was selling out theaters, multiple theaters across. I was breaking numbers. You know what I mean? But I was breaking records. But for some reason, Netflix said no. Whatever the case may be, it's a business decision. I get it. But now it's up to me to show them why they should say yes, right? So now I had to come out of my pocket and I had to pay for life from Seattle. That cost me so much money to do that. And still know that even though I shoot this and edit and cut it and it becomes a final product, they still said no. Like what I'm saying is—
They could
still say no because they already told me no. Me shooting it is just a risk on my own. I'm just betting on myself at this point. So
yeah, most people wouldn't do that.
No. And that's what I wanted to get at this book. Like, you know, sometimes we see people and, you know, we see how, you know, they're successful, whatever it is. Right. But no one really wants to dig deep and find out the backstory. Why don't you find out what they did to get there? And maybe that'll inspire you. You don't have to like me, but just love what I did. Love my hustle. And maybe that'll inspire you, because I will tell you, there's countless comics that inspired me. And that's what I did. I watched them and I was like, if they can do it, then I can do it.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's that hustle and those decisions that you made along the way really come through in the book, because not only are there things like the Live from Seattle special that you paid for yourself and then ultimately sold to Netflix, you also talk about opportunities that you did get that you turned down for various reasons. And I was really interested in those. I mean, there's one is the Kims of Comedy, which some people might know, this special with four Asian comedians that was offered to you and you said no. And then the other one is you were offered to be Chelsea Handler's sidekick on Chelsea Lately. So can you talk a little bit about those two things and what made you decide at that point in your career, when, you know, it's not like you were wildly successful at that point, but you said, you know, no, I don't want to do these things.
Yeah. And, you know, no disrespect to the Kims of Comedy, because I know I'm friends with, you know, them. I'm friends with Bobby, Ken Jeong, Steve Byrne. Yeah. I love those guys. And I was supposed to be number four. And I said no to it. I was working at Nordstrom Rack at that time. And seriously. And I was working at Borders Books. How ironic. I didn't even think of that. I was working at this store that they're no longer around, but it was called Borders Books, shelving books. And you know, I needed the money, man. My son was like a newborn. He was like one or two. But my goal and my dream was to be a stand-up comedian. And I wanted my hour special. And to me, I didn't understand, like, there were theme shows out at that time. There was the Kings of Comedy. There was Blue Collar Comedy, and, you know, there was other ones that, where there were themes, you know, but within those themes, those were seasoned veterans with hour specials. They already had them in place. They just combined together and made this package, which made it even more amazing. My whole point was, why is it that none of us have hour specials? That was my whole point behind that argument. I was just like, Bobby Lee is funny on his own. He deserves an hour special. Ken Jeong, and by the way, this is before Ken Jeong was on Hangover or anything. He was literally going by Dr. Ken Jeong. He would go up on stage with the guitar and, you know, and then go home because he was a doctor.
Because he was still a doctor. Yeah.
He was still a doctor. And then Steve Byrne, this is before he had his own TV show and he was directing the movies. Like, he was funny on his own. None of us had our specials. Not one of us. And that was my question. I was just like, well, we're all funny on our own and we all deserve our specials. Why do we have to come together as one to get on, you know, on Comedy Central? Why? We all deserve an hour special first, and then we could do a theme. That was my whole point. My whole point is we all deserve an hour, and I was willing to not do it because I knew I could get my hour. I wanted my hour, and I was going to fall on the sword, you know? And if I never got an hour, well then, hey, at least I said I was going to try and do it. You know what I mean? So, and like I said, I love those guys, and they all ended up being, look at them. They're all great on their own. But at that time I felt that I deserved an hour and not part of a theme, you know? And so that, and I stood my ground on that one. Don't get me wrong. When I saw it air on TV, I was kicking myself like, shit, I made the wrong decision. You know what I mean? And then I saw them all blow up, you know, and a lot of good things happened for those guys. You know, Steve ended up getting a TV show and Ken ended up movies, you know what I mean? And then of course, you know, Bobby with Mad TV, everything started happening. So, but you know what? Glad I made that decision that I did, because I wouldn't be where I'm at right now.
Yeah, no regrets on that one.
Chelsea Handler, on the other hand, people don't know this, but me and Chelsea were friends before any of this. You know what I mean? So I knew about Chelsea Lately before anybody. It was like her and like her producers and then like Joe Coy, which was the weirdest thing, because we became friends. We were opening up for John Lovitz together. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. And John was like, you got to meet Chelsea. She's hysterical. She's my only friend on MySpace. I swear to God, that's what he said. And I remember going home and opening up his MySpace page, and it literally was like Tom and Chelsea. And that's how I met Chelsea. And she, we just, you know, we just, her and I just have this chemistry, man. There's just something about her and I, man. When we're in the room together, it's over with. And that's how our relationship has always been. From the minute I met her, she's just, you know, she's Chelsea. She's amazing. And she told me about the idea. And it went, you know, it went far, like literally far, like to the point where we're about to shoot. And, you know, we took meetings and ideas, and we were throwing ideas around. And it was, by the way, none of this was my idea. Let's just get that out of there. This is all Chelsea's. This everything that Chelsea Lately was Chelsea. This was her brainchild. She came up with everything. I'm just saying, like, when she came up with the whole sidekick idea, I was throwing out little ideas of what I could do for the show. But when it came down to actually taping it, I pulled out. And for the same reason, I wanted my hour special and I wanted a Joe Coy show.
You didn't want to be her sidekick.
I didn't want to be known as a sidekick. I didn't. I knew if I took that on, you know, and it would be known as Chelsea Handler's guy, on, you know, the guy on the side. I didn't want to be Andy Richter or Ed McMahon. I wanted to be Joe Coy. And I said, no, mind you, I'm still working at Nordstrom Rack. I'm still shelving shoes. I'm literally letting go of a golden opportunity. She cursed me out so hard on the phone. I wish I would have recorded that, man. Like it'd be such good.
Send
like,
that
good,
to TMZ.
Oh man. No, I would. I'd give it to her for sure. But the way she yelled at me was just so Chelsea, man. The, you know, cursing me, every curse word you could possibly think of, telling me it's the stupidest decision. And I get it. She was offended. You know what I mean? She knew that this thing was going to be a hit. And here I am pulling away as if I don't believe in her. So yeah, I would have done the same thing. And she was just like, this show's going to be a hit. Fuck yourself. Good luck. And you fucked up. Like basically, like literally she, that's how she was talking. And then she hung up. And I remember going to work, and 6 months later, my ex-wife, my wife at the time, picked me up at Nordstrom Rack. And literally, she had no idea who Chelsea was, by the way, and picking me up at work. And then she's like, have you ever heard of Chelsea Handler? And my mouth dropped. And I was like, why? She's like, she's got this show on E. Holy shit. It's so funny. I'm recording it. I can't wait for you to go home and watch it. And we went home. I remember in the car, I was like, that's Chelsea. That's, you know, I said no to that show.
Yeah. Remember?
And, yeah. And then next thing you know, we're watching it. And I remember just saying to myself, I fucked up. Then Chelsea, you know, she called me and she put me on the show. And next thing you know, everyone thought I was like one of the cast members because I was on it so much. And so, yeah. And that's the beautiful thing about Chelsea, by the way. You know what I mean? She shares her limelight. She shares it. And she understands that it takes a team for something to be big as it was. Like that show needed all of us, not just Chelsea. It needed Chelsea for sure. But it also needed those guys on the panel. Like we were from Heather to Sarah to, you know, Josh, Ross, myself, Lonnie, like I can go on. Jen Kirkman, like the original cast, man, we were, it was amazing. Ben, was that, all those guys.
Was that sort of like your biggest exposure, national, you know, TV exposure at that point?
Yeah, man. I always tell her, thank you. I always say that to her. I go, you were literally the modern day Johnny Carson. Like, you know, when you're a comic, you always heard those rumors about Johnny Carson. If he waved you over to the desk, you made it. You made it. If you sat down and he interviewed you, it was done. That meant Hollywood, like he was literally telling Hollywood, you need to sign this guy indirectly. Like, and we missed that. None of the comics got that. You know, he already retired and times were changing. You know what I mean? And Chelsea was a big part of that change. She adapted to the new culture. You know what I mean? There was a new style of talk show. And if you made it on that show, you basically made it. Go look at the original cast, you know, the first three seasons, man, and look where they're at now. Look
yeah,
at
there's doing a ton. Well.
All man, come on. Well, who do I gotta say? You know what I mean? Kevin came from that cast. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, Kevin Hart.
Myself, Lonnie. Like, I mean, there's so many that just have blown up because of it, and we all owe her a huge thank you. You know.
Coming up, Joe talks about his Tonight Show debut, and he reacts to the recent apology from Jay Leno for his history of jokes mocking Asian stereotypes. Let's just say it's complicated.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're enjoying this episode, please hit subscribe. Along with Joe Coy, we have had some of the biggest names in stand-up comedy on this podcast over the past couple of years, including Whitney Cummings, Anthony Jeselnik, Chelsea Handler, and so many others. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be able to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Joe Coy. You did get something kind of close to the classic Johnny Carson moment when you went on Tonight Show with Jay Leno, though, right?
Woo! That guy changed my life. It was so funny because when I got the Tonight Show, you know, it was late in the game. There's a ton of talk shows now, you know what I mean? Everybody had a talk show and, you know, the Tonight Show was still the Tonight Show. You know what I mean? YouTube was starting to come in. You know, YouTube was starting to take over network. You know what I mean? So it didn't still have that same pool. You know what I mean? The audience, you know, back when Johnny was doing it, the whole world watched. And now there were so many outlets and so many shows. And, you know, but the Tonight Show still has that signature name. And I remember when I got the Tonight Show, a lot of my comic friends was like, well, at least you got tape. You know, they were.
It's not going to change your life.
Because, you know, it was coming from veterans that did it. You know, they were like, hey, man, I've done the Tonight Show 12 times, man. It's like, you know, it's good tape. You know, you can send it to clubs. It's good tape. You know, blah, blah, blah. But it's not, you're not going to get a TV show off. And I'm glad they said that. But in my head, it was my first TV exposure. It was my first national set, you know, on a huge platform, which was the Tonight Show. I was going to speak to people that had never seen me before. So my mentality was, I'm going for the jugular. I need my life to change now. I got four jobs right now and I'm tired of going on stage with mustard on my shirt because I was cleaning tables. Like, I need this. And it was so funny because Joaquin Phoenix went long. He went long, super long.
He was the main guest, yeah.
He was the main guest and he went super long.
Is this back in the days when he was like, doing the super
yeah,
weird
he's doing the super yeah. weird thing. And it was so funny because he was actually acting so weird that they came to my green room and they were like, hey, give us a couple of extra questions because I think Joaquin's leaving. Because in the break, he was like, I'm sick, I'm gonna go home. So they were expecting
he almost
him to
bailed.
Leave. Yeah, he almost bailed. And so they asked for like three extra questions for Jay to ask me. So I was like, yo, I'm about to do a couch segment. You know yeah. what I mean? Like, this is my life is about to change. So I'm getting all geared up. And then next, you know, we're watching from the green room and I'm like, yo, this guy's walking into my time now. Right. So then they walked in and are like, yo, Joaquin went so long that you're not even going to be able to go to the couch anymore. We just don't need you to say goodnight and then just wave to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And,
like you were going to close out the show.
Yeah. And Jay's going to walk up to you and wave with you. So stand at your mark. And I was like, I was so sad, man. I was like, man.
Yeah. You wanted that couch moment.
Yeah. I wanted that couch. But at the end of my set, man, I got that standing ovation. You know what I mean? And I remember looking to my side. You can watch the video, but I look to my side and I see Jay waving me over because I was waiting for him to come to me and he's waving me over and he sat me down. I got to sit at the couch and I remember we went to break and he was like, sorry, Jay, they told me to wait at my mark. I swear that's what they told me. He was like, no. I told him that you had to come over, man. I waved you over, man. You got a standing ovation. I never got a standing ovation when I was on a threshold. So it was really cool, man. It was one of the best moments of my life.
He has a young comedian from Las Vegas. You can see him on Comedy Central's Premium Blend, February 3rd. Also regular at the Laugh Factory right here in Hollywood. This is his first appearance on The Tonight Show. Please welcome Joe Coy.
Okay, I am Asian, so stop looking at me like a math problem. A lot of you guys are looking at me like, what flavor is that? Living in Hollywood, you get the worst compliments. The worst living out here when you tell people you're Asian. It's like, oh, you're Asian? I love orange chicken. What are you talking about? It's not a compliment, that's an insult. What do they expect you to do when they say that? Like, I'm supposed to go, oh, thank you. It is good, though, orange chicken. Oh, it's delicious. I love orange chicken.
It's so funny. It's like, you know, you obviously have so much admiration and respect for Jay Leno. We happen to be talking today, the day after he just put out this big apology. Did you see this?
Yes.
He put out this, you know, apology for basically decades of jokes of, you know, sort of Asian jokes that he now feels were not appropriate or what was your reaction to that?
It's beautiful. You know, like you can't look, if you're going to apologize, that means you're aware, you know, you're aware of what you've done and you can only appreciate somebody for that. You know what I mean?
He made a point to say, you know, he doesn't think this is cancel culture. He doesn't think, you know, he was pretty open about, you know, he really wanted to apologize for it.
You also have to understand, and I'm not giving Jay an excuse. You know what I mean? Like I said, you can be ignorant for so long, and you know, and if you choose to stay there, then that's on you. You choose to be that person. But if you want to learn and really be aware and understand and open up, then that's a beautiful thing. You know what I mean? That's what makes us move forward as a human race, right? And I would be lying if I didn't say, you know, the times that we grew up in was so normalized, you know what I mean? That we didn't think that was bad. We knew it was bad, but it's like, you know, like I said about my mom, you know, she felt sometimes like she was a visitor in this country. You know what I mean? Even though she was an American, you know, when I was going up those escalators and that kid turned around and pulled his eyes back and did the, on my mom didn't respond by saying, hey, that you can't do that to me. She responded by like, no, he's just being funny, Joseph. Because she didn't know how to approach that situation. You know, that's like 1983 or something like that, 82. I can't remember when, but I just remember it burnt a hole in my soul for so long. Because when I wrote about it in the book, it was such detail. You know what I mean?
Like, you remembered every detail.
Yeah. Obviously, the trauma was there. And then, of course, me just struggling with identity. You know what I mean? Me watching movies where Asian representation was a certain way and it's making people laugh. And to me, I'm like, okay, well then that's what I got to do. You know what I mean? I don't know what to do. Like I'm ignorant, you know what I mean? Instead of, you know, going a certain way, I played into the norm and it sucks. And I too have to apologize. You know what I mean? Like I'm glad that I was able to change it and figure it out the right way and represent, you know, my mom's culture and also be a good voice for the AAPI. You know what I mean? Like, this is what we need. And we're at that time now where it's happening. And I'm so happy. You know what I mean? We don't have to wait for the 7 o'clock news to report. And we don't have to wait for the 7 o'clock national news to pray to God that they talk about something locally that happened in Atlanta and tell the world about what happened in Atlanta. You know, there was a time where we prayed that we get to see something like that. See what happened in Atlanta with these women. You know what I mean? But now with social media, with TikTok and Instagram and Facebook, you're going to know about it right now. You're going to know about it today. And whoever did it we're catching your ass because we're a community now. And it's not just Asians, it's everybody. We're all bonding together and we're going to plaster your face all over the place and we're going to get these people in trouble and we're going to put them where they need to be put. And it's great to see this. If I could say that there's one great thing that's happening, it's that, you know, as it took something so evil and so horrific to happen, but what's coming out of it is actually beautiful. It's people are talking, people are apologizing, people are banding together and supporting. And I love that.
It's interesting you say, you know, you feel like you have things that you would to apologize for, or maybe even jokes that you regret, because there is this, you know, this sort of idea that white comedians, you know, are apologizing for certain things, but that maybe, you know, because you're an Asian comedian, that you wouldn't have to apologize for these things, or you wouldn't feel like you would need to. But are you saying that you do feel that way?
Well, I think we all should take responsibility, right? Like, I mean, we all fell victim for it, you know? But you also have to understand the pressure it is for you to be an Asian American, you know, especially during the times in the 70s and 80s and 90s where, you know, watch the movies, watch them, you know what I mean? How do you get inspired by that? How do you not think that that's normal? And okay, well, then that's what I got to do. So I do apologize, but I also understand the times. You know what I mean? It's a lot of pressure, man. It sucks. You know what I mean? Mr. Miyagi didn't speak Japanese, man. You know what I mean? He didn't speak it. That guy was a comic from America, stand-up comedian. And he had to, because those are the roles that were given. You know what I mean? Pat Morita, by the way. I'm sorry. I was just putting that to drive a point and let you guys know, like, as great as that character was, you know what I mean? As iconic as it was. But I'm just saying, that's how Hollywood was. If you want to play an Asian character, it's going to be this Asian character. No one knew that Pat Morita was just funny on his own. You know what I mean? Like, he was just an amazing comedic actor. You know what I mean? He was a great stand-up comic. You know what I mean? He came up with Richard Pryor and Robin Williams. He came up with those guys. You know what I mean? But look at the roles that were presented to him. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I get it. Like, yeah, we all had to do certain things, but it's look at the pressure that we had to deal with. Look at the roles that we're given. Look what was normalized for us. You know what I'm saying? And that's what I'm saying. You know, we were just trying to fit in.
There's this thought about sort of stereotypes in comedy, and whether what you're doing is sort of reinforcing stereotypes or challenging those stereotypes. And I think you've really done a lot to kind of challenge those stereotypes while acknowledging that there is truth to them.
Yeah.
So how do you think about that when you're crafting jokes?
What I love the most is I wanted to tell people I was Filipino without saying I was Filipino. And I knew that I had to do it with my mom. And I knew I had to embody that character. And my whole thing is relating to a mom character is very easy, because moms are just moms, right? I don't know if I already said this.
Yeah.
But at the end of my shows, when people walk up to me going, yo, my mom used to rub Vicks on my eyes when I was sick too, and they're not Filipino, do you know how happy that makes me?
Like it means your bit is relatable to everybody.
Yeah, and not only that, but it's a mom. You know what I mean? It's just a mom. And that's what I love the most. If we could just get past the tall grass and the weeds and just pull back and see the light, we'll all understand that we're all just the same person, man. We really are. We all live and breathe, especially moms. Moms just live and breathe the mom. They all do mom shit. You know what I mean? All moms have a handbag full of snacks. You know what I'm saying? Like, all moms find a way to take care of their kids by any means necessary. Like, you know, you tell those stories and you'll notice that we're all just relatable. We all relate to the same thing. So that's what I was getting at. When I tell those stories about my mom, I feel like I'm doing a great representation for, you know, Filipinos and Asians in general, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It does make me think, though, when you do a bit, like the long extended bit that you have about different telling Asians apart based on their accents. You know, obviously you have a lot of, you know, Asian fans who think that that's really funny and really relate to that. Do you ever worry that there's people in the audience laughing at it for the wrong reasons?
No, because if you're laughing at it the wrong reasons, then you're a racist.
Yeah.
Because that joke in no way is derogatory. not one sense of the word. There's no way you can even think of it that way. It's not even delivered that way. It's a compliment when you listen to that joke. And that's what I love the most, because I am telling you there is a difference. And I am telling you the accents are different. You know what I hate? I hate being an Asian American and being lumped in as if we're just one Asian.
As if it's all the same, yeah.
And that's offensive.
There's a way you can tell Asians apart from other Asians. It's by their accent, and only if they have accents. Out of all the Asians, Koreans are the easiest, because when a Korean person talks, they sound like they've been smoking weed all day. Like right before they talk, just... Koreans sound like Asian ghosts.
I wrote a joke back in the day where I go, I'm half white, half Asian, right? Which means my dad's in the military. And I go on by saying, I hate telling people I'm half Filipino, half white, because when they find out I'm Filipino, they give me the worst compliments. Oh my God, you're Filipino? I love orange chicken. Like... That's a real thing. You know what I mean?
I was in your Leno set, right?
Yeah. And when I was on Leno, I changed it to Asian, but I used to deliver that thing as Filipino. You know what I mean? But when I did the Tonight Show, I changed it to Asian. I put it general. You know what I mean? But then I wore the flag on my chest to let everybody know that I was Filipino. But that's not a joke that I just wrote. That's a joke from reality. You know what I mean? Like, and people would talk to me like that. Like, oh, you're Filipino. Like, what do you guys eat? Like chow mein? Like, no, man. Like, no, we don't eat chow mein. And so like, that's the education behind that. It's like, yeah, man, I'm doing a joke. But if you really listen to it, there is a difference. You know what I mean? And what I love the most is how the Vietnamese community embraced that joke. They love that joke. You know what I mean? Like they feel good. It's a representation, a good representation.
Yeah. They feel seen.
Yeah. They feel seen. They got a voice and, you know, it's empowering. It's great to have that type of identity, especially on that stage where everyone gets to watch it. And yeah, I love it. I love that joke. And I'm glad people are watching it and listening to it.
Do you ever worry about sort of being pigeonholed as a quote identity comedian, as opposed to being, you know, a broad comedian that everybody can enjoy?
Yeah, I love that question. That is such a great question, because like I said earlier, I'm talking about my mom and I'm talking about family, and I don't see the difference between me talking about my mom and doing an accent or watching Eddie Murphy do his mom in her voice. He's not delivering his mother. When you watch Eddie, you know, do his mom disciplining him, or even his Uncle Gus, you know what I mean? By the fire, he becomes Uncle Gus, right? He delivers those lines in their voice. It's still English, you know what I mean? So I don't know what the difference is between my mom or Louis Anderson's mom or, or Eddie Murphy's mom or anyone that's doing their mom on stage. But for some reason, there's this thing where people go, oh, he's doing that thing with his mom. No, man, I'm acting like my mom. She's speaking perfect English. You understand it. The joke isn't the way she's saying it. The joke is what she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if you don't see that, then you're acting like you don't see it. And I love that you asked that question, because Coming in Hot came out, my second special on Netflix, and Steven Spielberg watched it and he got it. And we're making a movie together.
It's incredible.
So anyone out there that's still struggling with, he's speaking to a specific audience. Well, I'm glad that specific audience has Steven Spielberg in it.
Tell me about that movie. It's called Easter Sunday, right?
Yeah, man. Easter Sunday. And it's with Dan Lin, by the way. Dan Lin, look him up if you don't know who he is. He's an amazing producer. Ride Back Films. It won, It 2, Aladdin, all the Lego movies. That's Dan Lin. And of course, I don't need to tell you what Steven's done.
Yeah.
But yeah, I went in, Holly Barrio and Jeb over there at Amblin Films, and you know, they said, Steven wants to work with you. Do you have any ideas? And I pitched a movie that I already had in the works with Dan. We just had no writers attached or anything like that. It wasn't moving forward yet, but it was. But I pitched that movie to Steven, and they took it in the room. And then they called Dan, and of course Dan is like, yeah, let's do this together. And now here we are. We're about to shoot it. So
What's the sort of story or themes of the movie?
Yeah, it's about my family. It's the struggle, you know, with me and my family. It's comedy, culture, it's chaos, and it all happens in one day, Easter Sunday. And
why Easter Sunday?
Easter Sunday is you know, Filipinos, that's our day, bro. I mean, we love Christmas, we love Thanksgiving, but Easter Sunday, we all come out for Easter Sunday, man. That's big. And you'll see what I'm talking about. It's a lot of food. It's a lot of family. It's a lot of church. It's a lot of outfits. It's a lot of karaoke. It's a lot of fights. It's a lot of talent. It's a lot of everything. And I can't wait to show that in this movie.
Are you going to star in the movie as well?
Yeah, it's my movie.
I want to talk a little bit about just these past few years of Netflix specials that you've put out, which are, you know, just have really exploded your career. And you talk, you know, you mentioned before Comedy Central and, you know, the Kims of comedy, and you had your first special on Comedy Central, and you have some harsh words for that network in the book, I think, just in terms of how that all went down. How do you think about that now, the whole Comedy Central versus Netflix thing?
I just never got it. I never understood what Comedy Central, and I love everybody over there, man. I know I do this a lot. You know, I dance on it, but you know, like, I don't, you know, I do, because I like, why would I be that mad at a bunch of, I was working at Nordstrom Rack, by the way. And, you know, a bunch of, you know, execs that gave.
Starting to think Nordstrom Rack is paying you.
I know they need to pay me, but I can't get too mad because they did give me an opportunity and they did invest a lot of money in me. I get that. They did it. They saw my act. You know what I mean? From Doug Herzog, Jim Sharp, to everyone else that was on that team that gave it to me. And they signed the deal with me, you know, for two specials. We shot them, but I didn't understand why it never got aired. I didn't get it. There was no YouTube at the time. There was no streaming services at the time. Like, I literally needed them to air it. They aired it one time and then it was done. And I just didn't get it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's such a different model, and, you know, that existed where you would have to watch it on TV, which is just like almost unthinkable now that you couldn't just watch it whenever you wanted.
Yeah. And then, you know, from Lights Out to all the way up until my Netflix special was, I think was 5 years, 5 or 6 years.
It's a long time.
Which was like, I remember every year going, dude, I have another special ready. Let's go. And they were never offering. They weren't offering. And I was just like, wow, okay. And I didn't get it because I was selling out everywhere. I was packing houses, man. I was selling out multiple theaters. And look, I'm not trying to brag. I'm trying to tell you my story. I'm trying to tell you my story and see the frustration where it came from. All the way up until, you know, Netflix, I still couldn't get in. I had to shoot it myself. And I didn't understand why. I knew I had to be at Netflix. Comedy Central offered when they found out that I was shooting one. They offered, but I knew that it would just die there. It was a graveyard. It was a graveyard. They weren't going to push it. They weren't going to promote it. They never do. And I knew that wasn't the platform for me. I knew Netflix was a play, because when they put, Netflix started using other people's content on their platform, when they started getting like stand-up specials from other platforms and putting it on theirs, that's when I knew Netflix had something, because they put Don't Make Them Angry on Netflix. And then I remember Twitter was big at the time. And I remember looking at my Twitter and my follower account was just like,
all of a sudden,
yeah, it was just like blowing up, and I didn't understand why. And then people were making references to my special, and I was just like, what? And then the like offers like, oh my God, you should come to South Africa. Oh my God, you need to come to Australia. Oh my God, come to Dubai, please. And I'm like, where is this coming from? And then finally someone was like, because I didn't even have Netflix at the time.
Yeah.
And then finally I remember DMing somebody.
Like, I better get Netflix.
No, I DM'd somebody and I was like, how did you see this special? And they were like, your Netflix special. I'm like, Netflix? And I remember asking a friend.
I have a Netflix special?
Yeah. And then I had my friend open up Netflix. No, I had my sister open up Netflix because she had it. And there it was, Don't Make Them Angry. And I was like, oh my God, there it is. And now people are starting to see it and people are loving it. And then all of a sudden it was gone again, because Netflix, because Comedy Central sold everything to Amazon, yeah. And then it was gone. And I was like, but that brief moment, those 3 months that it blew up, that's when I knew I had to be on Netflix. And that's why I it was like literally burnt inside me. Like, even though Netflix said no to me, I was like, I'm gonna get it on there. You said no today, but give me 6 months. I'll be right back. I have to go shoot it for you real quick. And thank God I did.
So we end every episode of the podcast by asking comedians about other comedians who have made you laugh the hardest in your life. And I want us to do a couple different categories. So the first one is from your childhood, who's sort of the earliest comedian that you remember really making you laugh? Because I know you loved watching comedy specials once you got HBO.
Oh, yeah, that's so true. But I will say the audio tape of Richard Pryor, I was crying laughing. Crying. my friend, I can't remember my friend's name that gave it to me. I think William, but he lived down the street and it was his dad's tape and he gave it to me. And then Eddie Murphy came along and made Delirious. And I think that was 1981-ish. I can't, don't quote me on it. 81, 82. I think I was like, how old was I then? Oh God, 81. I was 10 years old. So when I saw that, you know, saw Delirious live, I was like, I need to be him. Like, I need to be him right now. One of my favorite jokes, when he talks about getting hit by a car. One of the greatest jokes ever written of all time. Like, I just remember listening to that and just crying, laughing. I guess you're not going to need these shoes anymore. Like, it was so funny. Like, it was so brilliant, man. And then, of course, Ice Cream. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Ice Cream.
Ice Cream, man. Just... Like, I don't know what it was about Eddie that made me just drawn into him. But I think now that I'm older, I think what it was is he was so young himself. You know what I mean? He was 21 when he shot that special.
Yeah, you felt close to him in some way.
Yeah, there was just something about him. Like, it was like, you know, and I don't know, it was just genius. I love that special. And that's the one that made me become a comedian. Like, that's the one that I was going to be a comedian. And what's crazy is I played Constitutional Hall, my dream gig. By the way, I still have the text to my manager. I wrote down three things that I want to play. And one of them was Constitutional Hall. You know, I said the Forum were staples, the Opera House in Sydney, and Constitutional Hall in DC. Those are the three I had to play. And I played Constitutional Hall, which is where he shot Delirious. I did two shows there. And I remember going and getting a red jacket and wearing it. And it was amazing. It was amazing, man.
Have you played the Sydney Opera House yet?
No, and I could have too, because I sold Sydney out. Like, I sold it out. I sold so many tickets in Sydney. And I could have played. I could have played three opera houses, and it sucked because the minute we decided to play Australia, they decided to renovate the opera house. But I ended up playing the super theater out there, and it was amazing. So you got
to
see.
You're gonna have to go back.
Oh, I'm going back for sure.
So the next one is, who's someone who you either toured with or worked with in some way that just makes you laugh harder than anybody else, maybe offstage?
Oh my God, offstage. I mean, I'd be lying if I didn't say, you know, Chappelle. You know what I mean? You know, you could sit there and just watch Chappelle not only laugh, but like get enlightened and educated. You know what I mean? The guy's a genius. So like, I'd be lying if I didn't put him at the top. And then another guy that I toured with and laughed off stage, Mike Epps, opening for Mike Epps and then crushing in front of him and then going backstage and then just like watching him crush after me. Like, oh shit. All right, this guy. And then of course, Cedric the Entertainer. Like, oh my God, man. He's a god. Cedric's a god, bro. You know what I mean? From the way he dresses to the way he delivers his lines to the confidence, to the likability, to the content, to the swag, to everything. I mean, the guy is just, he's a legend, man. And I love that guy. Yeah, I opened for him. And another guy I crushed in front of. I crushed in front of Cedric. Like, I think there was like 3,000 people there to see him. And I was working at Nordstrom Rack. And I remember crushing hard. Like, I remember when I said goodnight, in my head, I'm like, yo, there ain't no way this motherfucker is going to be able to follow this.
How's Cedric going to follow this?
There ain't no way Cedric's going to follow this. And I remember turning to my left and seeing him on the side of the stage, just bouncing. Now he got a fedora on. I tell the story all the time. He's got his whole outfit on. Everything matches. And I walked towards him, like, just like, what the fuck? And he looked at me, he's like, that's what I'm talking about, Joe Coy. Make me work for this motherfucking money. And then he fucking gives me just daps me up and then walks out on stage. And I remember about 30 seconds into his routine, I remember saying to myself, none of them remember me. Not one person in that audience even... I don't even think they knew there was a guy that opened for Cedric at this point. It's done. Rest in peace, Joe Coy. It's gone. So yeah, that's one of those guys.
And then is there somebody who's sort of like an up and comer or, you know, a generation below you who you want to shout out, who you think's really funny and deserves some attention?
Oh man, there's a lot of kids out there, man. God, there's a kid, Mateo Lang.
Yeah, Mateo Lang.
Yeah, he's so funny. He's going to be big. He's going to be so big. You know, she's not small anymore. You know what I mean? She's kind of killing it right now, but Fortune Feimster.
Another Chelsea Handler alum.
Yeah, she's a Chelsea Handler alum, but what she's done as far as like her stand-up is just...
She's so funny,
it's amazing.
Yeah.
I love her stories, man. I could go on forever, man. Yeah, Beth Stelling, man. So funny, man.
She's fantastic. I just had her on a few months ago when her special came out.
Yeah, so funny, man.
She's great. Thank you so much for doing this, Joe. It's really, really great to talk to you. And I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
So yeah, congrats on everything.
You're awesome, man. Thank you.
On all of your success.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much to Joe Coy for being my guest on today's show. His new memoir, Mixed Plate, is available now wherever you get books. And we'll put a link to purchase it in the description for this episode as well. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.